I'm going to go ahead and get us started with our next session. Patient experience data, use and regulatory decision making and labeling. And of course, we have our disclaimer that these slides are the views and opinions are those of the presenters and not of FDA or CPATH, and they are each person's property. So the objectives of the session today are to define patient experience data, PED, dispel myths, misconceptions, and misunderstandings about PED, discuss some examples of use in FDA's regulatory decision making and labeling, and present case studies in dermatology and gastroenterology to highlight different approaches to collecting PED from patient advocacy group perspective. And so I'd like to introduce our panelists and presenters and panelists today before we get started. We'll be hearing from Robin Bent, from the Director of Patient-Focused Drug Development Program at FDA, Michelle Campbell, who you've heard from earlier today from Office of Neuroscience, Ellen Kodroff, President and Founder of CURED, the campaign urging research for eosinophilic diseases, Sarit Kovacs, clinical reviewer from Division of Gastroenterology at FDA, and Mark Yale, Advocacy and Research Coordinator, International Pemphigus and Pemphigoid Foundation. And so it is my pleasure to turn it over to Robin for her presentation.
There we go. So good morning again. I hope everyone had a great break. And so during this session, I'm going to talk to you about patient experience data. Oops. And to do that, I'm going to talk first a little bit about patient-focused drug development. My papers are hitting the screen and it's making things all confused. Apologies. I know I keep trying to make it a touch screen and it is not. All right, there we go. So patient-focused drug development is a systematic approach to help ensure that patients' experiences, perspectives, needs, and priorities are captured and meaningfully incorporated into drug development and evaluation. Patients are uniquely positioned to inform FDA and medical product developers about what it's like to live with their condition, how it impacts their daily life, and their experiences with available treatments, and about what risks they're willing to tolerate. This information can inform medical product development and also inform FDA's benefit-risk assessment. And so I really love this quote because, to me, it really kind of captures patient-focused drug development. We, especially those of us who work with patients in a clinical setting, sometimes suppose that we know what it is that's important to patients, what symptoms are most burdensome, what patients consider meaningful improvement. We suppose that we know, but it really is better to engage patients and hear directly from them about their experiences, their priorities, and their preferences. So the collection of patient experience data is important in medical product development for two reasons. Patients are experts in their own experience of their disease or condition and the ultimate consumers of medical products. And patient experience data can inform medical product development and enhance regulatory decision making to address patients' needs. Through the 21st Century Cures Act, Congress provided FDA with a really high-level definition of patient experience data. Within the PFDD guidance series that we've talked about several times already today, we have worked to operationalize that definition. Patient experience data includes the experiences, perspectives, needs, and priorities of patients related to, but not limited to, the signs and symptoms patients experience and how those affect their day-to-day functioning and quality of life, the course of their disease over time, including the changes that patients experience in their symptoms and functioning, patients' experiences with treatments for their disease, including the symptoms and burdens related to treatment, as well as patients' views on potential disease or treatment outcomes and how they weigh the importance of different possible outcomes, and how patients view the impact of the disease, treatment, and outcomes, and their view of potential trade-offs between disease outcomes and treatment benefits and risks. And so what part of the patient experience can be collected or measured? There are many parts of the patient experience that can be measured, and these include the impact of the disease and its treatment on the patient, such as the signs and symptoms of a disease or condition, patients' chief complaints, including which signs and symptoms patients consider the most burdensome, the burden of living with or managing a disease or a condition, for example, the effect of the condition on daily functioning, the challenges of any existing treatments, and the burden of participating in clinical studies. It can include patients' perspectives about potential and current treatments, such as their expectations of benefits. I'm a slide ahead. There we go. Their expectations of benefits, their willingness to tolerate harms or risks, what patients consider acceptable trade-offs or benefits and risks, and patients' attitudes towards uncertainty. It can also include patient views on unmet medical needs and available treatment options. And collecting this patient experience data can lead to an enhanced understanding of the natural history of the disease or condition, including prognosis, severity, and chronicity. Patient experience data can be collected throughout medical product development. It can begin at the launch of a discovery program, or it can be collected independent of any specific medical product development program. Depending on your study or your research goals and the research questions, qualitative, quantitative, or mixed methods may be appropriate for the collection of patient experience data. Regardless of the method, the way questions are framed is critical to collecting unbiased patient input. Questions should be framed as neutral as possible, and leading questions should be avoided. The research objective defines the appropriate population for the included population, and the selection of appropriate population is essential to getting information relevant to addressing the research objectives. When studying patient experience, it's important to obtain patient experience data that are not only relevant, objective, and accurate, but also representative of the target population. Sufficient representation may depend on the characteristics of your target population, the disease or condition under study, and the intended use of the study results. Patient experience studies should be inclusive and patient-centered. That means considering patients' language and culture, accommodating abilities with accessibility modifications, inclusive research practices with children, and integrating caregiver perspectives. And so here you can see there are many sources of patient experience data. They can include clinical outcome assessments, patient-focused drug development meetings, patient preference studies, interviews, focus groups, social media, online patient communities, and really a bunch of other sources. All of these can be useful sources for patient experience data, but the data collected from these sources are not all the same. One challenge that I think we have when we're talking about patient experience data is that it's not a single homogenous thing, right? Like, we talk about patient experience data, but it really is kind of, it runs the gamut. And so it sounds like we're talking about one thing when we're talking about it casually, but this can be a challenge. Information gained from a PFDD meeting while providing valuable information is not the same as same quality as data from fit-for-purpose clinical outcome assessments that are collected as part of a well-designed clinical trial. Patient experience data can be used to inform both the design of clinical trials and endpoint development and selection for a clinical trial. If the patient experience data you are planning to collect is expected to inform regulatory decision making, we recommend that you consult FDA guidance, other PFDD resources, and FDA early and often, which is, feel like it's the theme for the meeting today. That and it depends. early and often to discuss the potential value of patient experience data, the types of data to develop, and the fit-for-purpose tools that you plan to use, as well as your approaches to collecting complete data and the details of your data analysis plan. Okay, there we go. Another term that we talk a lot about is patient input. And patient input includes patient experience data, but it really can kind of be a bit broader. Patient input can also occur throughout the medical development process. Early in the process, patient input can help researchers identify and measure outcomes and burdens that matter most to patients. For example, during the PFDD meeting for vitiligo, we heard from patients that it wasn't just depigmentation that was bothersome to them, but it was also the unpredictability of the condition. Many patients, particularly those with depigmentation on their faces, would not consider a treatment effective unless repigmentation was sustained for a certain period of time. Moving on, as clinical trials are developed, patient input can help researchers design better clinical studies. For example, I've heard one pharmaceutical company talk about how when patients with age-related macular degeneration participated in a mock trial initiation visit, patients provided feedback that shortening the visits and providing transportation to the site would improve people's experiences participating in the trial. The following year, the actual trial experienced no patient dropouts, which was a significant improvement over the general dropout rate of about 18%. And next, so during the pre-market review, available patient experience data in the form of clinical outcome assessments or patient preference studies can be an important part of the submission and can inform FDA's regulatory decision making. So I'm not going to provide examples for this because I know that my FDA colleagues are going to go into more detail later in the session. And during the post-market phase, patient input can lead to more effective communication of information to both patients and providers in order to facilitate informed decision making. As you can see, a lot of opportunities for patient input and patient experience data happen throughout drug development and not just, oh gosh, I just lost my place. Please hold. The text could not be any larger. Almost there, I swear. I'm lying. All right, so here we go. So as you can see, a lot of opportunities for including patient input and patient experience data happen throughout drug development, not just for regulatory decision making. And so for an example, I added this slide about patient-focused drug development meetings. But what I really want to talk about is how we see these meetings fitting into medical product development. Because when these meetings first began in 2013, the plan was that these meetings, where we hear directly from patients, would be very helpful in informing FDA's benefit risk assessments by providing critical insight into the therapeutic context. And they really absolutely do. But as times have passed, and we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of that first meeting, we've learned that the meetings have value well beyond just providing FDA with information. In fact, I was at a meeting last year where an industry consultant told me that he refers all of his clients to the PFDD meeting reports because they provide a treasure trove of information, his term, not mine. Early in the drug development process, these meeting reports can provide companies with insights into the condition, they can provide information about potential new targets for therapies, and identify potential possible endpoints that may be meaningful to patients. They can provide information about what symptoms patients consider burdensome and what patients are looking for in a treatment. And so we've heard, and you'll hear shortly from Mark, that these meetings can also really jumpstart collaborations between patient groups and medical product developers. And we've heard that meetings can bring patient communities together and jumpstart advocacy efforts. And so in many ways, our thinking about these meetings has evolved as we've been encouraging patient groups who are considering hosting these PFDD meetings to hold them early when there may not be a lot of drug development going on in the space, where there may not be a lot of treatments available, where endpoints are still being discussed. Because this is the time where patient experience data gained from the meeting can really launch additional rigorous scientific efforts, because this can really be critical. And I think this brings up an important consideration when we're talking about patient experience data, because frequently when we talk about patient experience data, the immediate follow-on question is, how is FDA using patient experience data? And that's a reasonable question, and you're going to hear some of that about that shortly. But the question can also do a huge disservice to patients and patient experience data, because FDA is really not the only group using patient experience data. I think that we really need to reframe that question to how is medical product development using patient experience data, because it really is important throughout the drug development process, not just at the time of regulatory decision making. And so with that, I am going to end, and I'm going to once again hand the microphone over to Dr. Michelle Campbell, this time to speak about how FDA uses patient experience data in decision making. Yes.
Well, thank you, Robin. And I would say, besides being asked all the time about a clinical outcome assessment and endpoint, the second most thing we get asked about is, how are you going to use our patient experience data in regulatory decision making? And often when I speak to patient groups before the externally led patient-focused drug development meeting, this is actually a really important conversation to patients. Because you know in the audience that drug development takes time, and when the patient-focused drug development meeting may happen, may not be near a time when a product's either in development or in regulatory review. And so the outcome of that engagement is not necessarily visibly seen for many years, perhaps. And I'm really excited for the examples today to really show how we do use the information we gather from various patient experience data sources, one being the patient-focused drug development meetings, and how we do incorporate it into our thinking and the advice that we do provide when a question has come into us from an individual sponsor. So I really want to thank Robin for highlighting this term that was pleasantly given to us when 21st Century Cures passed, right? And so for some folks, they're like, oh, it's a new term. We've never been doing this before, right? But in reality, let's think about this. We've been considering patient experience data for a really long time. And we have examples to prior of 2016 when this term first emerged in law. We have disease-specific guidances that talk about approaches to collecting evidence to support that clinical trial endpoint. And we know often that evidence is coming directly from perhaps a patient or a caregiver. We have the 2009 PRO guidance that laid out how to collect patient information to be able to support a trial endpoint. We have the PFTD program, and as Robin just highlighted, we are entering what our 10th year of it, and we've learned a lot. So what I do think that this term did give us is really solidifying the importance of making sure that we are capturing the lived experience of our patients and their caregivers who are participating in medical product development, and making sure that we're taking all aspects to that various incorporation of the medical product development, because that is a long time. It's not just when we get to that phase three and we're going to submit that marketing application for us to review. It is a very long process, and there's a lot of opportunities, as Robin laid out, where patient experience can play an important role. So we were tasked as part of our task with, I think, our last PDUFA as well, and in 21st Century Cures, to really do a report that looks at how does the agency really look at patient experience data in our marketing applications. And so I would say that we see patient experience data throughout the drug development process. We see it when you're coming in for advice, an individual in your IND meetings, right? You may be presenting us the data to help make decisions and get advice on. But obviously a lot of times, and there's a lot of rich data there, but it's what comes into that marketing application that a lot of people really want to focus on. And so ERG was contracted out to write a report that reviewed new molecular entities of both NDA and BLAs that were received between June of 2017 through June of 2020 for both CDER and CBER, and that a regulatory decision approval decision was made by 2021. And this report did come out in 2021, in the summer of 2021, I believe, Robin, the summer, yes. And so what they did is they actually talked to reviewers. They went through and looked at how we capture patient experience data. And so this chart actually shows the different types of patient experience data that is mentioned in our reviews. And so I really do encourage folks, I know everyone really goes to the label and they go to section 14 because that's what you want to do, is get to, you want to make it into that section. And I know my CPATH colleagues have heard me say this many of times. Go read those reviews though. If it's a review that's been posted publicly on our website, they actually provide a really good breadth of information. They describes our thinking. What were we thinking about when we made that decision? It actually is really sometimes maybe more informative to what had to fit into this really tiny label, right? And for any of us who've been through what that's like to try to get stuff on a label, you know, there's a lot of nuanced decision making, and you're maybe missing some really relevant essence points that you can actually find in the review. So I always encourage folks to read the reviews if they're available, because they provide some additional information that you won't get out of just Section 14. So what you do see is that most of our applications that came in during that time acknowledge some form of patient experience data was submitted into that marketing application. And you can see the breakdown of what type of COA, if it was a COA. Obviously, it adds up to more than 100 because you may have multiple types of COAs into a program, which I always think is awesome because we're getting different viewpoints, and it tells us a great story of what that experience is like. But what you also see is that during that time, we are starting to go to other sources of patient experience data being acknowledged in our marketing applications, such as the voice of the patient reports from PFDD meetings or natural history studies. But do remember that this data has to be submitted, right? So we have to be noted to go look for it in a certain section of that marketing application. So perhaps there's data that wasn't included that might exist. This is just data that's referenced to us and submitted in that marketing application. So a lot of folks talk about the table. So, right, what about that table, Michelle? Can you talk about that? So this is what is in our template. And you will see it if you go look up a new drug, NME review that is at drugs at FDA, that we have to mark that for two pieces. Was their data submitted? And is it described somewhere in our review, right? Because, you know, most in case it's always described. But we do have to acknowledge this, and you will find this pretty early on in our reviews of what the different sources of data, and then where you can find a description of that data somewhere else in that review. Our reviews can be pretty long. And so in every marketing application review, this table is part of it. So I want to give you some examples. Oh, it did come out really good big. when you're putting things on a slide on your screen, you don't know how they're going to blow up, and I'm actually really happy this turned out well. So I'm going to show you two examples. And then we're going to actually hear an example about how do we use this information. And so this first one is actually from a June of 2018 approval in hyperhidrosis, where the Division of Derm and Dental highlighted not only the various PROs and clinician-reported outcomes that were used, but they also talked about references that were provided on patient experience. They acknowledged that, and they acknowledged the patient-focused drug development meeting for hyperhidrosis, and I actually cut out that section from the review that's public, and you can see how they described what they learned from that PFDD meeting, and I think this is, again, what our patients want to see, is how we're using this information, and this is one example of what was really taken back to that division about that about hyperhidrosis. Another one is out of my therapeutic office that I'm a part of that actually just was approved early March, right, Emily? Was it March? Just like a month ago. This is for a rare disease. This is trofinetide for Friedreich's ataxia. And this is another example that lists not only the various endpoints that were used of COAs, but also information from patient-focused drug development meetings. I'm sorry, I said Friedreich's ataxia. This is Rett syndrome. Sorry. Neuro's been a little busy these days. And it talks about their external-led patient-focused drug development meeting and how that information helped us inform us on that patient experience. So these are just two examples, one from a non-rare disease, one from a rare disease, that shows that we really do value all the different types of patient experience data that comes into us for review. Another question that's often asked is the big one, right? I mentioned Section 14, that's where we want to, that's our dream, right? Is how do we get patient experience data labeled? And so we have to still follow our regulatory requirements that we have to meet for inclusion into the label, right? So this includes the rigorous science behind the data collection, the analysis plan. Is anything pre-specified, not pre-specified? We still have to treat it with the same rigor we would treat if we were going to put that primary endpoint description into the label. That rigor is still needed. This is another opportunity if you want to talk about including something in a label that may not fit that COA framework early with a division to see what it looks like. What does the division think? How is this adding informative information? We do have to remember who the label is written for, and it is written to help inform clinicians. And so how does this information help? This is a great example of why you need to come early, you need to have the rigor. This is why the PFTD guidance series is a good way to help us go back and utilize all of those things. Obviously, we've been highlighting more of the latter ones here, but really those earlier ones, guidance one and two that you know we talked about a couple years ago, those are your foundations to be able to collect that quality data with that rigor. That's going to give you there, and how that can get transformed into the information that if scientifically and done with rigorously, could support something to go into the label. And so I can't not say this, but this is exactly why, you know, I'm going to highlight again the May 4th meeting to talk about, you know, one example of how to get into the label with the endpoints. So this is just a perspective of how, as reviewers, we consider patient experience data, but I will say that all my colleagues, not only in the Office of Neuroscience, but the other therapeutic offices, we're going to hear from another therapeutic area in a moment. You know, we really value the patient experience data. We value our patient lived experience, our listening sessions, all those things that Robin talked about the last session now. We do value those opportunities, and we do take that information back into our everyday. It may be hard to translate to what that looks like sometimes because of how long drug development can take. But we really do appreciate those opportunities to learn from all stakeholders when it comes to the lived experience of a person's disease or condition. So with that, we're going to actually transition into that experience. I'm going to turn it over to Ellen to talk about her experience from a patient group.
First, I have to just thank you so much. I just am so honored to be here, and just the fact that you care so much about the patient. I cry every time when I just can't believe how much you all care about the patient voice, and it really means so much to not only me, but to all organizations that try and encourage this happening. So thank you for having me and letting me share our story. My name is Ellen Kodroff. I'm the president of the CURED Foundation, CURED being Campaign Urging Research for Eosinophilic Disease. I started CURED in 2003 when my then 10-year-old daughter was diagnosed with an eosinophilic disease. We were told there was no cure or not even a treatment for this disease. And being the youngest of my three children, I was amazed. I didn't have any experience with research or anything like this, and I thought, well, where's the money for the research? And the doctor told me there wasn't really funds for research. You were funded for, you know, a year or two, and then you had to find your own funding. And I asked him how much he needed, and he told me $1 million would be a really good place to start. And I think he thought I was crazy. I said, I don't know where or how, but I'm going to get you $1 million, and we're going to have research for this disease. And we focus on eosinophilic esophagitis, eosinophilic gastroenteritis, eosinophilic colitis, eosinophilic asthma, and hypereosinophilic syndrome. Since that time, we've raised and donated very close to $7 million to medical research, and thank you. We work with centers of excellence around the United States. We spread awareness We are always there to support our patient community through this difficult journey. CURED hosts a biannual conference to educate patients, doctors, researchers, and industry. Our last conference was attended by people from 9 countries and almost every state in the U.S. It was a goal of mine to not only be able to share research between the doctors, but to allow patients to see the research being done so they can understand what is being done to help them, and also to help educate the doctors and the researchers and industry on what it was like living with this disease. So we always allow a patient to talk during these sessions. CURED has shared the patient voice with the SEEGER Consortium for the past 10 years. SEEGER stands for Consortium of Eosinophilic Gastrointestinal Disease Researchers. It's made up of a group of doctors and researchers and patient advocacy groups that work together to find a better treatment, and it's funded by the NIH and also the patient advocacy groups. We reach out to the patient community to share information and to recruit patients for medical trials. Since patients have relied on and trusted CURED for the past 20 years, we're able to explain the importance of why trials are needed and how they help move research forward. I think that doctors and researchers sometimes don't understand that patients don't really understand why they should enter a medical trial or why some trials are funded and the patients don't have to pay for treatments, and some other trials, patients do have to pay for part of their treatments. And they think this is all about doctors making money. And, you know, they, like, don't want to do it. And, you know, to hear from a patient experience and to explain to a patient why they need to do this. And it's really helpful. And so reach out to your patient community to explain to them why this is helpful and why this helps move research forward. We help pharmaceutical companies reach patients to provide answers to surveys to help them understand the patient's needs. We've spoke to the teams of industry in helping them developing drugs for eosinophilic disease to help motivate them to explain the challenges met by these patients. We're able to share information with the FDA. CURED has a vast outreach to patients. We host a private support group on Facebook with over 15,000 members, as well as Instagram and Twitter, that allows us to really understand the patient's needs and wants. We're able to help design and recruit for medical trials, being able to share research findings with doctors as well as patients is very helpful in moving research forward. Funding this research has also enabled CURED to have a voice in what is most important to the patient community. When starting CURED, no one was asking us about the patient's thoughts or concerns. No one really understood what it was like living with an eosinophilic disease. I remember about maybe 17 years ago, I was asked to present and speak with FDA and industry about what it was like living with this disease. And it just so happened that right before I was asked to speak, maybe a month, my daughter had to remove all food from her diet. She was 14 years old. I had to sit her down at the kitchen table, of course where food is served, and tell her she could no longer eat. She would either have to have a feeding tube or she would have to drink an amino acid formula, and that was all she could have by mouth for 3 months until she would be scoped, and then she could try one food every 3 months and have an endoscopy to find out if she could still eat that food. So when people were saying, maybe this disease isn't so serious, maybe this disease isn't so painful, I was there to tell them, this disease is so life-altering, and the quality of life is affected so bad. When I heard my daughter say she was isolated from her community, from her friends at school, from her life. I mean, everything revolves around food. So I think that when I was able to share that story, it was impactful and it helped everybody to understand that this disease is serious, we need medication, and we need treatment. And over the years, we've been able to really share that voice by allowing patients to tell their stories. It was eye-opening to hear challenges, the quality of life of patients with eosinophilic disease and what they live with. Either removing 1 to 6 food elimination diet to removing all food and relying on elemental formula. Just imagine your life without food. 10 years ago, pharmaceutical companies became interested in hearing about the patient voice, the adult patients and pediatric patients. Employees became motivated by patients' personal stories and why it was important for their drug development. 6 years ago at the Patient Education Conference, CURED invited patients to share their emotional and medical journey. Pharmaceutical companies, FDA, and other industries to hear the real life experiences. CURED Patient Education Conference features live patient experiences has been a major turning point to bringing the reality of how desperately patients need treatment. We had a mom talk about when she first met her husband, he had food allergies. She never heard of food allergies. She didn't know anyone, but she realized she could kill her husband by serving him peanuts. And this became like a very serious thing in her life. And when she had her first child, was diagnosed with eosinophilic esophagitis, ended up on a feeding tube, second child, third child, and fourth child, and then her husband was diagnosed. Her life was turned upside down, and just being able to share her story, people came up to me from that point on at the conference, and just they were so touched by her story and realized how important it was that we came out to their pharmaceutical companies and we spoke to their employees that were working on these drugs to let them know that this is very important and what they're doing is very meaningful to a very large group of patients. The endoscopic reference, the EREFs, we were able to help just by sharing patient stories and helping disseminate questionnaires. CURED was instrumental in recruiting patients for these clinical studies and helped identify these reference numbers. Dysphagia symptoms questionnaires, the DSQ, is a 3-question patient-reported outcome measurement that was successfully developed and tested. The DSQ had content validity and the scores accurately measured dysphagia frequency and intensity. CURED helped develop and disseminate the DSQ. The more researchers, pharmaceutical companies, and FDA hear the patient voice, the more it gives them a clear understanding of how great FDA-approved medications are needed. Like I said at the beginning, CURED was there where there were no safe treatments and no cure. Being part of this timeline since the beginning has allowed us to have an important role of getting our very first FDA-approved drug last May. Some of the symptoms from living with EOE or any eosinophilic disease really is pain, swelling, skin rash, reflux, choking, difficulty swallowing, nausea, loss of appetite, stool containing blood or mucus, cramping, diarrhea, polyps, protein loss, anemia, malabsorption, development delay, bleeding, nutrition deficiencies. As you can see, not easy to live with. At 14 years old, before my daughter started formula, she was 4'6" starting high school and 68 pounds. After being on the formula for about a year and a half, she was 5'2" and 110 pounds. So really, quality of life, it's just so important. So treatment options, we would love complete healing of the esophagus, stomach, duodenum, and colon. Resolution of function impairment of these diseases to improve quality of life, prevent disease reoccurrence after remission, and limit treatment side effects. Only one FDA-approved drug for EoE, no approved drugs for lower EGIDs. Patients must use off-label drugs, off-label therapy, relapsing and refractory diseases, unknown side effects from long-term use of these off-label therapies. Patients must balance the burden of disease, cost, and therapy. Long-term commitment. Through all the philanthropic financial support, CURED Foundation has invested in expertise in basic and translational science, clinical trial readiness, industry partnership, engagement of key stakeholders, especially the NIH, the FDA, and patients. We are so grateful to have our first FDA-approved drug for eosinophilic esophagitis. Although so many patients are experiencing less symptoms and even remission, this drug will not help every patient suffering. We need to continue working with stakeholders and FDA to help improve more patients' lives with not only EoE, but all of the eosinophilic diseases. I can't thank you enough for this opportunity to share our story and for all of the work that you do and how much you really, really do care about the patients. And I'm there to tell the patients that because they really don't understand. So as much as we think you might not understand, the patients don't really understand either. So I'm here to tell you I share this with the patients all the time. I tell them we have an army working for our disease, and we're so grateful for all of you. So thank you.
Good morning. My name is Sarit Kovacs. I'm a clinical reviewer in the Division of Gastroenterology in the Office of New Drugs in the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research at the FDA. Today, I will be presenting a clinical regulatory perspective on the use of patient experience data in regulatory decision making. Before we begin, I have no conflicts of interest, nothing to disclose. This talk reflects my own views and should not be construed to represent FDA's views or policies unless otherwise noted. And in this talk, when I refer to drugs, I am speaking about both drugs and therapeutic biologics. On behalf of the Division of Gastroenterology, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting us to be part of this meeting. The assessment and meaningful incorporation of patient experience data in regulatory decision making is a vital part of patient-focused drug development. Today, I am pleased to be able to share with you a regulatory perspective of the impact that patient experience data has had on regulatory decision making. Highlighting how the indications that we manage in the Division of Gastroenterology have directly benefited from the evaluation of patient experience data, including an example of a recent approval that represented the first ever drug approval for a serious condition affecting the esophagus, as we heard from Ellen. Patient-reported outcome or PRO assessments are a type of patient experience data and are often used in clinical trials for gastrointestinal or GI disorders. This is partially because patients commonly experience clinical symptoms as primary manifestations of their GI disorders. These can include troubling symptoms, as we heard from Ellen, such as constipation, diarrhea, heartburn, abdominal pain, that often have a substantial impact on how patients feel and function in their daily lives. In many GI conditions, more objective outcomes such as irreversible morbidity and mortality or death are not practical or feasible to assess in a clinical trial. This is because clinical trials evaluating these endpoints require a large number of patients that need to be followed across many years in order to be able to detect a treatment effect. As a result, clinical trials for GI disorders frequently utilize PRO assessments as primary or co-primary endpoints. and demonstrating so that the drug is actually leading to a clinical benefit to patients. FDA processes and regulatory decisions are guided by laws and rules or regulations. These include statutes from federal or state legislature, such as the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and the Code of Federal Regulations. Title 21 of the Code of Federal Regulations is reserved for rules of the FDA. In general, the laws establish the basic requirements, and the regulations fill in the details or gaps to ensure that the expectations are clear. FDA guidance, though issued external of these formal legal processes, also play a vital role in the regulatory dialogue between the agency and external stakeholders. And FDA guidance describes the agency's current thinking related to a regulatory issue to assist sponsors as they pursue the development of drugs and therapeutic biologics by providing a recommended approach. These documents may also be leveraged to facilitate communication between patients, patient advocacy groups, clinicians, the academic community, the pharmaceutical industry, and regulatory agencies. The importance of PRO assessments in GI clinical trials is reflected in multiple FDA guidance for industry, including, as you can see on this slide, guidance related to eosinophilic esophagitis, celiac disease, and the symptomatic treatment of internal or external hemorrhoids. In these guidance documents, FDA has provided recommendations to position PRO assessments as primary or co-primary endpoints in order to demonstrate substantial evidence of effectiveness for development programs for drugs to treat the GI disorders. Recommendations for the development and implementation of PRO assessments are also discussed in recent draft guidance for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, both published in April of 2022. I would like to highlight the critical importance and impact of patient-focused drug development for programs for treating eosinophilic esophagitis, or EoE. EoE is a chronic immune or antigen-mediated esophageal disease and is part of a larger group of disorders known as eosinophilic gastrointestinal disorders, or EGIDs. In patients with EoE, large numbers of white blood cells called eosinophils are found in the inner lining of the esophagus when this tissue is looked at under a microscope. Normally, there are no eosinophils in the esophagus, and the eosinophilic inflammation is referred to as histologic activity. Clinical symptoms in patients with EoE vary depending on the age of the patient. Infants and toddlers often present with feeding difficulties. School-age children are likely to have vomiting or pain. And adults and adolescents commonly report dysphagia, which is a term used to describe difficulty with swallowing or pain with swallowing. Complications of EoE can include food impaction, where food gets stuck in the esophagus, which may require medical intervention. EoE can also lead to esophageal stricture or an abnormal narrowing or tightening of the esophagus. This can make eating or drinking more difficult or painful. Patients with severe esophageal strictures may require dilation of the stricture and/or alternative medical sources of nutrition. By current estimates, EoE affects somewhere between 1 to 2 per 2,000 people, which roughly translates to 166,000 to 332,000 people in the U.S. with EoE. In patients with EoE, clinical symptoms or features and histologic activity can vary independently, and for this reason, the treatment goals of EoE include resolution or reduction of signs and symptoms of active disease to provide relief to the patient, as well as healing or control of the esophageal inflammation and its complications. As I mentioned before, the FDA guidance, Eosinophilic Esophagitis Developing Drugs for Treatment, was developed and published to promote drug development for this serious condition by describing the agency's current thinking to assist sponsors by providing a recommended approach. This guidance built upon decades of collaborative work amongst patients, advocacy groups, physicians, researchers, scientists, pharmaceutical industry partners, and regulatory agencies, This guidance was initially published in draft form in February of 2019. After receiving and incorporating many thoughtful public comments from stakeholders, FDA issued a final version of this guidance in September of 2020. A key component of this guidance is the recommendation to assess co-primary endpoints to support the efficacy of a drug for the treatment of patients with EoE. These endpoints should include statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvement from baseline in signs and symptoms compared to placebo, and using a well-defined and reliable clinical outcome assessment, or COA, instrument, as well as documentation of histologic response defined as a peak eosinophil count of less than or equal to 6 across all available esophageal levels. As a co-primary endpoint, inclusion of a patient-focused clinical outcome assessment in clinical trials is considered essential to demonstrate clinical benefit and support both potential drug approval and labeling claims. Additionally, in this guidance, FDA encourages COA development to begin early in drug development and provides recommendations for anchor-based analyses to aid in the interpretation of the COA endpoint results and to help determine whether the effect is clinically meaningful to patients. On May 20th of 2022, dupilumab became the first FDA-approved therapy for the treatment of EoE in adult and pediatric patients ages 12 years and older. I would like to highlight the following excerpts from the FDA news release that detail the symptomatic co-primary endpoint that supported this drug approval. The development program for dupilumab for the treatment of EoE used a PRO assessment called the Dysphagia Symptom Questionnaire, or DSQ, to measure the patient experience by assessing the clinical symptoms of dysphagia based on a report that came directly from the patients themselves. The DSQ was developed and was selected for use in this program based on qualitative and quantitative data, which identified and supported dysphagia, defined as difficulty swallowing, as a concept and symptom that was representative of the patient experience and important to adults and adolescents with EoE. The results from parts A and B of the pivotal clinical trial are shown here in purple and yellow, the two middle boxes on the slide. The pivotal clinical trial was appropriately designed to distinguish the effect of dupilumab from other influences or factors that can make patient experience data difficult to interpret, such as variability in the natural history of the disorder, the effect of placebo administration, heterogeneity in the presentation of symptoms, changes in individual reporting patterns, and changes in behavior as a result of clinical trial participation, which may positively or negatively affect the frequency or severity of EoE symptoms. The drug development program for dupilumab also utilized FDA's recommendations to conduct anchor-based analyses to aid in the interpretation of the clinical meaningfulness of the COA endpoint results. These analyses incorporated the patient's perspectives to support that the DSQ endpoint score improvement in patients who received dupilumab in the clinical trial was representative of clinically meaningful improvement in dysphagia as compared to placebo. This means that from the patient's perspectives, treatment with dupilumab resulted in a meaningful clinical benefit. The FDA approval of dupilumab represents a major advancement for patients in EoE with EoE in the U.S., as it was the first drug found to be both safe and effective for the treatment of EoE. The development program for dupilumab was supported by years of past collaborative efforts across multiple stakeholders, including patients, advocacy groups, physicians, academic researchers, scientists, and pharmaceutical industry partners, as well as regulatory agencies. This drug approval was directly related to the successful application of the principles of patient-focused drug development, including the thoughtful collection, analysis, and interpretation of patient experience data, which supported their incorporation into regulatory decision-making. For stakeholders seeking advice and recommendations to promote the successful incorporation of patient experience data into drug development, this slide shows three of the available pathways for interaction with FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, or CDER. One pathway is through medical product development within an individual drug development program that has the potential to result in drug approval and labeling claims. Here, advice is given and decisions are made on a case-by-case basis within the context of each individual drug development or research program. A second pathway is through CDER's COA qualification program, which is outside of an individual drug development program and is considered a pre-competitive space. It is available to develop either COAs or biomarkers that potentially result in a qualification statement from the FDA for use of the COA or biomarker in a particular context of use. A third pathway is through critical path innovation meetings or other meetings. These are also outside of an individual drug development program, and these meetings consist of a discussion of the science, medicine, and regulatory aspects of innovation in drug development. These are non-binding, informal meetings with relevant FDA experts. And the scope of these meetings include early biomarkers and clinical outcome assessments, natural history studies, technologies, and clinical trial designs and methods. In closing, within the Division of Gastroenterology, as well as across other divisions and centers within the FDA, promoting the inclusion of robust, meaningful, and representative patient experience data is vital in advancing patient-focused drug development. The recent approval of dupilumab for the treatment of EoE highlights the value of incorporating and assessing the patient experience in drug development in a meaningful way. Thank you again for inviting me to participate in today's meeting and share a clinical regulatory perspective on the implementation and use of patient experience data in drug development.
My name is Mark Yale, and I'm the Research and Advocacy Coordinator for the International Pemphigus and Pemphigoid Foundation, or IPPF, and I'm not hiring, just so you know. I'm also a patient living with mucous membrane pemphigoid. The IPPF is a patient advocacy organization whose mission is to improve the quality of life for all patients affected by pemphigus and pemphigoid through early diagnosis and support. I would like to thank you for inviting me to speak today about patient experience data and bringing the patient experience to the FDA and other stakeholders. I want to provide some background on the diseases. So pemphigus and pemphigoid are rare autoimmune blistering diseases, or AIBDs, that affect a small percentage of the population. Pemphigus is intraepidermal and affects the superficial layers of the skin and the mucous membranes. The three major types of pemphigus include pemphigus vulgaris, pemphigus foliaceus, and paraneoplastic pemphigus. In this group of potentially life-threatening rare disorders, antibodies are directed against proteins of the cell membranes in the epithelial cells that serve as a zone of adhesion to anchor contiguous cells together. Prevalence varies by subtype, and with pemphigus, which is the most common of the three, there are 5.2 cases per 100,000 per year. In contrast, pemphigoid is subepidermal, and autoantibodies are directed against the basal layer of the epidermis and mucosa. The six different subtypes include bullous pemphigoid, mucous membrane pemphigoid, pemphigus gestationaceus, epidermolysis bullosa acquisita, and anti-P200 pemphigoid, and linear IgA bullous dermatosis. Pathogenesis and management are quite different for all of these different conditions, and again, prevalence varies by subtype, and incidence is 12 in 100,000 adults per year. Since these diseases are rare, there is limited access to specialty centers with experts in autoimmune blistering diseases, and often this will result in delay of diagnosis. As you can see, there are several complaints reported by patients, many that are extremely debilitating, that affect daily activities. And they also have a significant impact on patients' quality of life. Patients with these diseases have an elevated mortality rate as well. The picture on the left, which is bullous pemphigoid, is from a patient that attended our patient-focused drug development meeting. And so is the one on the upper right-hand photo, which is pemphigus vulgaris. And the lower right-hand photo is an example of oral mucous membrane pemphigoid. So on January 25th, 2023, the IPPF hosted an externally led patient-focused drug development meeting called Understanding the Unmet Needs of the Pemphigus and Pemphigoid Community. As nothing like this had ever been done before with the disease community, our biggest expectation was to gain insights on the patient perspective. We also had goals to illustrate the burden of the disease, identify areas of unmet need, and collect patient experience data that could define what meaningful benefit might look like for patients in therapeutic interventions. We collected patient-reported experience data before, during, and after the meeting. Today, I'm going to share some of the data that we collected pre- and post-meeting. During the meeting, patients and AIBD experts shared their lived experiences so that clinicians and researchers could better understand the unmet needs of the patient community and also develop tools that better assess the benefit of patient therapies. We began by discussing the current treatment strategy landscape. The goal of current therapies is to suppress and/or eliminate disease-causing antibodies or B cells that suppress inflammation. Unfortunately, there are only two FDA-approved therapies for pemphigus. Corticosteroids for the treatment of pemphigus and rituximab are clinically approved only for pemphigus vulgaris and only for that subtype, not the others. Other therapies are prescribed off-label for pemphigus, such as oral immunosuppressives and intravenous immunoglobulin. Additionally, there are no FDA therapies for pemphigoid. All of the therapies, including immunosuppressives and anti-inflammatory agents, IVIG or intravenous immunoglobulin, and monoclonal antibodies such as omalizumab and dupilumab are prescribed off-label. Although the efficacy of rituximab corticosteroids for pemphigus is supported by two pivotal randomized clinical trials, evidence shows that there are limitations of rituximab and corticosteroids, including their transient therapeutic effect, which necessitates repeated infusions for disease control. Chronic immune suppression can lead to serious infections and impaired response to vaccines. Studies have shown increased mortality from COVID-19 in autoimmune blistering disease patients treated with immunosuppressive therapies. Chronic corticosteroid use can lead to numerous side effects, including weight gain, mood swings, insomnia, bruising, and stretch marks. In addition to serious medical complications such as hypertension, diabetes, glaucoma, cataracts, and even bone fractures. Next, we discussed the current limitations of approved treatments for both diseases. The ideal goal of treatments are to have complete healing of blisters and resolution of the functional impairment associated with the disease, improve quality of life, and prevent disease recurrence, and limit the treatment side effects related to corticosteroids and immunosuppressants. However, due to so few FDA-approved drugs, patients are left with off-label therapies which may or may not be approved by their insurance carriers. These limitations highlight several unmet needs in pemphigus and pemphigoid therapy. The main problem in pemphigus and pemphigoid management is that they're relapsing and they're refractory diseases, like Ellen had pointed out, which require higher cumulative steroid doses and result in more side effects from therapies. Physicians and patients must remain vigilant for rare and potentially life-threatening infections due to immunosuppressive treatments. Patients need drugs that are safe and they're well tolerated, which avoid chronic immune suppression. Oral, topical, and subcutaneous routes of administration would be beneficial to patients who may have difficulty arranging travel or logistics for intravenous infusions. Drugs that work fast to control the disease are important, as most drugs for pemphigus and pemphigoid take several months to have therapeutic effect. For quality of life, patients want to avoid the use of corticosteroids. As you can see, patients with these diseases struggle every single day to balance the burden of the disease with the burden of therapy. Validated disease activity scales for pemphigus and pemphigoid have been developed over the last 15 years by an international panel of medical experts prior to the patient-focused drug development era. For our ELPFDD meeting, we used the Autoimmune Disease Quality of Life Survey and the Treatment of Autoimmune Disease Quality of Life Survey. These two validated patient-reported outcome instruments help us understand how these diseases and their treatments affected patients' quality of life. The reliability and validity of disease activity instruments should represent a patient's health status. Clinical trial endpoints for pemphigus and pemphigoid are based on consensus outcome definitions, not clinical outcome assessments, that illustrate what patients value most. We heard from patients that they would value 50 or 75% improvement in their disease activity, like endpoints that have previously led to drug approvals for atopic dermatitis and psoriasis. Interestingly, studies have also shown that the PDAI and BPDAI perform better than the psoriasis activity and severity index, or the eczema activity and severity index, which have been used by the FDA for drug approvals in their respective diseases. Another major challenge for pemphigus and pemphigoid drug development is that recent clinical trials in pemphigus and pemphigoid are being required to by the FDA to use an endpoint of clear or almost clear disease using a 5-point investigator global assessment scale. This is problematic because IGA scales have not been co-developed with pemphigus and pemphigoid patients. Patients should have a say in how they define clear or almost clear. These scales should also separate disease activity from the disease damage, as they are better to demonstrate response to therapy than an IGA 5-point scale that include damage in their assessment. Endpoints for pemphigus and pemphigoid clinical trials could be comparable to those used for another similar autoimmune disease, such as myasthenia gravis, which has received drug approvals based on a 2-point reduction in disease activity scales. The FDA should consider endpoints based on a percent reduction in disease-specific activity scores. These are complex diseases, and like most rare diseases, finding a one-size-fits-all scale will be difficult. Patients need endpoints that are tied to meaningful response to them. The endpoints for clinical trials for pemphigus and pemphigoid are based on the consensus outcome definitions that were published over a decade ago. These consensus definitions were intended to assess the standard of care therapies, mainly of oral immunosuppressives, as they were published before clinical trials for pemphigus and pemphigoid were even in development in the United States. This means that these definitions were also developed before the use of biological drugs for these diseases. These endpoints for clinical trials included complete or partial remission on minimal steroid doses or off steroids while remaining on investigational therapy being evaluated. Minimal steroid doses for endpoints should also be considered very carefully, as prednisone doses of 10 milligrams or greater can have substantial therapeutic effect. Unfortunately, we saw a trial recently fail due to last-minute change in prednisone dosage endpoint. Defining meaningful improvement for patients is critical. In several studies, data indicates that patients' quality of life can be restored despite not achieving complete remission of disease activity. Requiring complete disease clearance is not a meaningful response to a drug, but an eventual outcome and impedes drug development for pemphigus and pemphigoid. After our ELPFDD meeting, a Voice of the Patient report will be published, summarizing input shared by patients and their caregivers, along with results of the patient polls and surveys that we took. I'd like to share with you today some of the patient experience data that we collected pre and post ELP-FTD. And overall, we had 500 responses. 262, or 52.4%, were pemphigus patients, and 225, or 45% of the respondents had pemphigoid. We asked patients, of all the symptoms that you experience because of your condition, please select the top three symptoms that have the most significant on your impact, significant impact on your daily life. Over half responded that pain from blisters and lesions had the most significance, while almost 40% of people had trouble eating or swallowing. Imagine not being able to eat or swallow every time you and your family sits down to have a meal. Patients describe the sensation of eating like chewing and swallowing glass, or drinking liquids like swallowing razor blades. We asked patients which specific daily activities that are most important to you are you unable to perform at all or as fully as you would like to because of your condition. Over 40% said eating. Almost 30% said that they didn't have any difficulties performing any daily activities, which corresponds with the number of respondents that said that they were currently in remission or not having any disease relapse or a flare. Almost a quarter of people said that they were unable to perform personal hygiene, and close to 20% of people said that they were unable to walk. Just wearing shoes or clothes can be difficult with these diseases due to the large bullae on the soles of your feet, or the clothes coming in contact with your skin causing bleeding. We then asked patients, what are the most significant downsides to your current treatments and how do they affect your daily life? Almost 60% said that the side effects from their treatments affected their daily life, and nearly 30% said that the treatments took too long to work or the cost of treatment had an effect on them. During the patient testimonials during the ELP-FTD meeting, many patients described their side effects from the treatments. One patient said, taking prednisone was one of the worst experiences of my life. At the risk of sounding dramatic, there were days when I wondered if taking steroids was worth it. A couple of times being dead seemed like a reasonable alternative. We asked patients, what specific things would you look for in an ideal treatment for your condition? Over 90% of people responded to have little or no side effects, and over half of the respondents said that an ideal treatment would be easy to take, cost-effective, would be easily accessible through their insurance, and would have an effect on wouldn't have an effect on their daily lives. Even prior to holding the ELP-FTD meeting, the IPPF recognized the importance of collecting patient experience data. We launched our Natural History Registry study in 2017 in conjunction with the National Organization of Rare Disorders, or NORD, and the FDA. The study collects, stores, and retrieves data for analysis and research studies and is being utilized in Rare Disease Cures Accelerator Data and Analytics Platform. This longitudinal study collects patient experience data on sociodemographics, medical diagnostics, treatments, and disease progression, the management and care of patients, and their quality of life. Patient advocacy groups like ours play a unique role in patient experience, not only in experience, but in the data that we can collect. Patient advocacy groups are a direct link to patients, caregivers, and their families who have the trust and credibility with the communities that they serve. They have a unique perspective because their mission is to solely support patients. Many groups, like the IPPF, have advanced research capabilities and work with academic researchers to better understand the diseases they support. Patient advocacy groups can also assist with clinical trial education and enrollment, facilitate focus groups, conduct natural history studies, and most importantly, help develop clinical endpoints that have meaningful benefits to patients. So, what are the key takeaways about patient experience data and what have we learned? Rare autoimmune blister diseases like pemphigus and pemphigoid are severe, life-threatening diseases that cause significant burden on the day-to-day lives of patients. Access to therapy remains an issue, with few clinically approved drugs and most drugs prescribed off-label. Patients must weigh the burden of disease versus the burden of therapy. The goal of therapy is to control diseases without serious side effects. Clinical trials should use endpoints that reflect issues that are most important to patients and consider the physical and psychological impacts of these treatments. Given the side effects of steroids, minimal therapy with disease improvement is the primary goal of therapy, and complete remission of disease is secondary. New therapies don't have to be perfect. They just have to provide meaningful benefit to patients. Validated tools for measuring disease activity should not be overly stringent, and clinical trial data indicates that patients' quality of life can be restored despite not achieving clear or almost clear disease activity. With a steady increase in clinical trials, patient advocacy groups seek to continue their collaboration with the patient community, industry, and the FDA to improve access to treatments and quality of life. I want to thank you for your time and attention today, and I'm going to pass it back over to Sonia.
Thank you so much, Mark, and all of our panelists. Great presentations. We do have about, I would say, 12 minutes for Q&A, so I'd like to invite people to come to the microphones if you have a question or a comment. And I have a couple of questions to get us started. My first question, and this is kind of related to Michelle and Robin's presentations. You both talked about the 21st Century Cures Act, and I'm just curious to hear from you both, and Sarita, if you'd like to comment as well. What impact did having patient experience data put into the law have on its use within FDA?
That's a great question. sorry, it's just microphone issues. I mean, I think that, as Michelle said, there's been a lot of patient experience data is submitted to FDA in the past, and I think that, you know, having it codified maybe kind of put a highlight on it, but I don't know, and it's kind of hard to tease out from the language in the 21st Century Cures Act versus the PFDD program, because as Michelle mentioned, the drug development process is so very kind of long, and so it's kind of hard to tease out, I'd say, specifically what the 21st Century Cures Act did. But I think as we're looking at this kind of holistically as kind of all of this, I think we are seeing a shift towards really incorporating the patient perspective throughout the drug development process and throughout our review processes at FDA.
Yeah, I actually say maybe acknowledging it more in our reviews. So I think we've always used it, but now we have a place where you can go find it, right? And I think actually I would flip that a bit, Sonia, too. I think it actually made our industry stakeholders think about what they should be also submitting to us that may help explain more their data and the story of that patient experience through their trial as well. So I think it's, for us, it really just highlights the work we do every day, and you can go find it and see some explanation, but I think really some of it is really actually on the other side of you should really be putting this into your marketing applications and collecting this information. And having us be able to review it, because you know there are times when we're like, well, I really wish I would have known about this, right? It happens. And again, we can only review what's submitted to us in those applications. And so, you know, we don't want to obviously have a missed opportunity that might help explain, you know, like I like to talk about telling the story of what was really going on with the patients, what is their lived experience like, and really we can only make those determinations based on the evidence that's submitted to us in those applications and also during that IND process.
And I would just add to that, you know, I think the PFDD guidances appeared kind of in both PDUFA and in the 21st Century Cures Act. I think we're still seeing, as we're rolling out those PFDD guidances and hoping to kind of add some transparency and de-risking the process a little bit, I think we're going to still continue to see the impacts of that as time moves on.
Yeah, I think that's really important because it's not one of those things, as I mentioned, like an instantaneous thing. This is one of these things where we're going to have to be patient and really look at the evaluation of it over time. You're going to have to really wait for those drugs, those development programs that were starting when these things were passed. You know, we're going to have to wait 5 to 7 years maybe to really see the bigger impact. I think we're seeing great impact right now. I think there's more to come.
Great.
Thanks so much. Calvin, please ask your question.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for great presentations. This is Calvin Ho from AstraZeneca. I've been mulling over Mark's presentation for a bit now, and I have a question for our FDA panelists. So I know there's a public comment period whenever there's a disease-specific guidance that's being released, but outside of that specific context, is there some other mechanism for patients and patient advocacy groups to bring methodological insights to what FDA is doing?
So there is a pathway through the critical path innovation meetings where you can get non-binding informal advice and request certain types of FDA experts that you would like to be meeting with in person and speak about different methodologies. As long as it's innovative in drug development, then that is one pathway with the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research.
Great. And this opportunity is open to patient groups?
Yeah, it's open to patient groups. Just Google FDA CPIM. It is run out of our Office of Translational Science. And it is really geared. It is, number one, not to be IND specific. So if you come talk about your IND, we're not going to talk about it. I say that way because people do this. I mean, it's one of those things, like, why do you say that? Because someone did it. I'll be the honest one. And so it is really meant for these opportunities of workings from patient groups, perhaps collaborations in the pre-competitive space, to get, as Sarit said, this high-level advice that's non-binding, which makes people a little bit more comfortable because you're not beholden to it. But it also brings internally various internal stakeholders with what that is. You know, whatever the presentation and the description of the content, the methods, for example, those experts will be identifying. And if it's something, if it's a disease or disorder or a concept that may impact maybe one of our other centers, we do invite our other centers. So I know we mentioned the CEDAR things, but if you haven't noticed, we've got like a lot of the centers are here today. We do talk to one another. And so these kind of listening session type, these style meetings, we would, you know, if it would impact them as well, we would invite them. Erica, do you have a question or do you want to add?
Oh, wait. Yes, I'm on now. Sorry, guys. Erica Lyons, I'm the Associate Director for Therapeutic Review within the Division of Gastroenterology, and I just wanted to add a small plug for a patient listening session. And so this is one amazing opportunity that we have to hear directly from patients, and it can be requested from advocacy groups. Our main intent and focus during those meetings is to hear from the patient experience and not necessarily to discuss the methodologies or analysis and interpretation of what might become a usable endpoint for a clinical trial. However, as Mark highlighted, early interaction and early engagement of all of the stakeholders is of the utmost importance to ensure that drug development can be successful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Erica. And I just want to add from our experience at CPATH with the CPIM, it was a very productive meeting, very open discussion. So I highly recommend that avenue. And I think it does bring together the different groups within FDA. So you can have your disease, your division representatives, your clinical division, methodology from DCOA, you know, you can bring all the different stakeholders together and have a very, very open dialogue. So highly recommend that. I have a question for Ellen. in our discussions, I think you met, and Sarit's mention of the adolescents reminded me, I think you mentioned that there was discussion around the age range for the drug approval. And I don't know if it was the study to generate the evidence for the approval or the approval itself, but can you talk a little bit about CURED's participation in those discussions around the age range and how that went?
Yes, so when they were first doing the trials for dupilumab, the age range was going to be 18 and over, and they had been working on getting it lowered, and I was actually asked to be on a call to express our feelings about why we needed this age dropped. And obviously, 12 years old, junior high school, life is challenging. for a child without rare disease or any disease, but add this to their plate and it becomes very challenging. And so I was able to share stories. We actually have had patients attempt suicide. Actually, I do know one child who committed suicide at 14 years old. It's a lot of pressure for these kids. So we were able to help encourage the age to be dropped to 12. And while I have your audience, we would really like it lower than 12. I know they're working on it. And just always hearing the patient's stories. And I can tell you, with 15,000 people in a support group, I hear constantly how life is better with this drug. And then all these people with younger children have to listen to this and know that, you know, they may have to wait 8 years or they may have to wait 6 years before their child's eligible for this drug. And so we really need to encourage, you know, obviously we want it to be safe, but to think about lowering the age, it's really difficult. Quality of life, like Mark said, for our disease, probably for every rare disease. So just food for that.
No, thank you so much for sharing that experience, because I think that highlights another way that patient advocacy groups can share the patient experience in a way that is impactful on drug development and drug approvals. Erica.
See, I didn't sit down yet, so you have to let me sit down, and then I'll stay seated, I promise. So thank you, Ellen. I thank you for that answer, and thank you for providing that perspective, because just transparency and communication, when we think about drug development, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. And so industry sponsors may be hesitant to enroll children in trials because it's difficult. It's harder to study when we think about, can they answer the questions that are written in this PRO? What age can they do? It presents an entire new set of challenges for them. And I think this just highlights how important the collaborative approach is to promoting drug development and trust the entire age spectrum of affected people. The EOE guidance that Sarit so wonderfully mentioned, it says we encourage in the pivotal trials, go down to adolescents, because we know that that is a feasible achievement marker that industry partners can do. But we always encourage, and it even says in the guidance that we encourage drug development to go and affect it and touch every child that is going to be affected and suffer with this condition. So thank you for that plug for pediatric development. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Erica. So I'm going to wrap up the session. I know I'm standing between you all and lunch, but I do want to say that this is just the beginning of the conversation around patient experience data. There are upcoming meetings at which this topic will be discussed, and I know many of you in the audience may be attending these, so I wanted to highlight a few. At ISPOR 2023 in Boston next month, there'll be a presentation on current practices and challenges when submitting patient experience data for U.S. regulatory decision-making industry survey on Tuesday, May 9th. And at the DIA Global Annual Meeting in Boston, also in Boston, there will be a session on patient experience data in the label, Closing the Loop, and Robin will be part of that session on Tuesday, June 27th. So for those of you attending those meetings, keep those in mind to hear more about this very important topic. So thank you all for